Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. And I'm now here with Paul Gottfried. Paul Gottfried is a historian and writer, philosopher of the, you know, well, it might be better actually if you describe yourself in your own terms. Paul, first of all, thank you for agreeing to do this. I think a lot of people have been excited to see you on Millennial. So thank you very much. How would you describe your own background?
Well, you know, I find it strange, although I wrote a book that was very critical of Leo Strauss that Cambridge published about 7-8 years ago. I think I would answer your question the way Leo Strauss once answered the same question. How would you describe yourself professionally? What do you do? And I would probably say I'm an intellectual historian, an historian of ideas. Who has written widely about political movements and the history of historiography, and I think who has written, at least in recent years, more specifically on the history of fascism, the history of the right in Europe and the United States.
Right. Okay. And I should say that. You now have a YouTube channel with Gottfried, which I think is linked below, so people can find you there. All right. So, what I want from my perspective, one of the ways in which you I first heard about you must have been 5 years ago now, if not more, was that you were the man who coined the term alternative right. And I think Richard Spencer popularized it. He created the website Alternative Right, but it was, I think you were the person who initially said, we need, in America, we need an alternative right. So what did you mean by that? I think that's because I think it would be interesting to know what you meant when you said an alternative right.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that afterwards, when I was asked to explain what did the term mean, I indicated that it is not identical with what became the alt-right after I gave my talk. And ever since then, the conservative movement has banned me as, you know, the person who created the alt-right. They also banned me for the preceding 35 years. For various other reasons that had nothing to do with the alt-right. It was that I disagreed with neoconservatives primarily. That's why they banned me from all their journals and attacked me with some regularity in National Review. But after I used the word alternative right and Richard Spencer then shortened it to the alt-right, I became associated with white nationalism. I keep telling people I'm not a white nationalist. I am not a white nationalist, not because I consider white nationalists worse than Black Lives Matter, Antifa, the two idiots who are running in the Democratic Party in Georgia. I think all of them are infinitely more pernicious, dangerous, destructive of civilization than white nationalists who hardly exist anymore in the United States or most of the Western world. I am not a white nationalist because I think we see as a white civil war that is going on. Whites are trying to destroy other whites, and some of them use blacks, others use Muslims in order to achieve this end. If there were no blacks, if there were no Muslims, you'd have, you know, the whites who want to destroy other whites still doing the same things, in my view. But when I coined the term alternative right, what I was referring to was a right that would represent what I thought were traditional right-wing positions and would not be controlled by the conservative movement, which I consider to be neither a movement nor conservative. I was hoping that alternatives would develop on the right. And there are a number of alternatives that have developed on the right. You know, I see them. I mean, some of the people in Newsmax I've listened to, someone like Michelle Malkin, for instance, sounds like somebody on alternative right. There are many people who are criticizing the conservative movement from the right, and who are not being intimidated by leftist media, who are not trying to ingratiate themselves with leftist friends who work at the New York Times, the Washington Post or network programs. They're not people trying to make careers in New York City or Washington. They're people who represent what I consider to be a serious right. So that to me is the alternative right. Now, if you ask me, is the alt-right part of it? I suppose it is in some very generic sense. Because, you know, anything that is to the right of the conservative movement, which keeps moving to the left, by the way, on social cultural issues, anything that is to the right of that conservative movement is, in a sense, an alternative right. But there are some alternative rights, I would argue, that are more valuable and make a good deal more sense to me than other forms of the alternative right.
Do you think that the terms left and right still have the currency and relevance that they did 50 years
ago? Absolutely. No, as a matter of fact, I've argued that whereas words like conservative and liberal have no meaning whatever anymore, because they've been used, they've been so so bastardized, so hybridized, so made to fit, you know, any kind of political or commercial need, that they mean nothing anymore. I mean, I've written books on both on liberalism and the conservatism, making that point ad nauseum. I mean, people are probably sick of hearing me make that point. I think right and left have ontological status. I think they describe conflicting or rival understandings of the world. The right, as I've indicated, accept inequality as the natural human condition. You're not going to change this. Any attempt to change this must result in horror, the kind of horror that we're soon going to be living through as the multicultural totalitarian left fastens its grip on us even more. So one must accept inequality as the natural condition, and also recognize its benefits. Certain things like family are now organized hierarchically. You can't make them equal. All communities, genuine communities, rest on hierarchy. The other principle of the right, I would argue, is particularity. That the right is not concerned with universal states. It's not concerned with transcending nation, race, whatever. It simply accepts the context in which human life is possible, which is based on fixed relationships to family, to nation, and so forth. So I think those are the two defining characteristics of the right. I could come up with others if you give me a few more minutes. I think the right also accepts moral absolute. Of course, the left accepts moral absolute, so I can't say that's distinctively right. I mean, I think the, if anything, the left is more morally fervent than the right. I think it's driven by morality to a point where it wants to destroy the human race.
Yes, I think so too, actually. And that's a surprise for my generation, because we grew up thinking that the left, or at least some of us, thinking that the left was about understanding, acceptance, tolerance, open-mindedness, and love. And concern, compassion for other people. But now the left today seems shrill, intolerant, and frankly hateful.
No, I would agree. I think hypermorality is an essential characteristic of the left. Hypermorality based on a notion of universal sameness and equality. Now, of course, in the short and middle run, you have to accept black racism, gay rights, women beating up on men. And so this is all good, because you have to correct the inequalities. We have to address these inequalities. So therefore, we have to live through hell in order to do this. This is sort of the purgatory we go through on the way to living in a uniform, homogeneous, egalitarian society, which is what the left is after. The left, by its very nature, is totalitarian. The left doesn't stumble into totality. That is the nature of the left, because what they do is that they rebel against the natural human condition, which is based on particularity and inequality.
Do you think that Do you think that that is, can be said of all, like, just sort of ordinary milquetoast leftists as well? Do you think that even they have this desire for totalitarian? Because I think it's something that is, again, it seems to be something that's emerged in the last 10 years among ordinary leftists. Like the idea of, well, the First Amendment, for example, is something that they're now up for corrupting and curtailing. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think even as recently as 10 years ago, I would suspect that most left-wing people in America would not be up for that. There seems to be that the shrillness seems to have increased on the left.
I think you're being very kind to the left.
You know,
I just turned 79. I've lived with the left my entire life. And let me assure you, they've always been intolerant. But, you know, on the way to power, you have to be nice. You have to be, you have to tolerate the other side until you can seize power. Now, I would distinguish between, shall we say, you know, leftists who see the bigger picture, which is one of control and social reconstruction, massive. And those who just go along for professional reasons or to fit into society because their wives are nagging the hell out of them and have these leftist friends with whom they're supposed to get along. But leftists who take their leftism seriously are by nature totalitarian. I can't see what else they can possibly be.
Right. Yeah, I think I understand what you mean by that. So there was a question that occurred to me about the right, you would say, is, I mean, I think that's been said before, but that it is, the right is partly defined by an acceptance of hierarchy. It's just and that means inequality. It's just a fact of life. But on the left, you see, this is why I asked you if you still think that the terms left and right have much currency, because in some ways they seem to be becoming obsolete. For example, the left today seems to be very happy with capitalism, which is, you know, was that always the case? Because it seems to me like that's something quite new. Mm-hmm. And then another aspect would be that the left seem to thrive on snobbery, intellectual snobbery. So they don't really believe in equality either, because they're obsessed with being better than other people morally.
No, I think both points are well taken. You know, I've just finished a long book on anti-fascism, and my argument is that anti-fascist and capitalism, they are quite compatible. You know, the whole phenomenon of world capitalists who are, you know, committed to destroying the society of normal white people or people living in flyover country, whom they detest, and they're quite willing to incite blacks or others to destroy them and to destroy their history, you know, and to burn their flags and tear down statues. They love this because they're at war with other white people. I think what has happened is that capitalism itself has become totally detached from, you know, its rootedness in a Western culture. In America, there's a very close tie between capitalism and bourgeois Protestantism. That is almost entirely gone. You find very few bourgeois Protestants who are capitalists nowadays. And the form of capitalism has changed. You know, you're dealing mostly with finance capitalism, people who own stocks and so forth, and do not really have a stake in society, you know, as somebody once did who owned a factory, a family factory. So it's a kind of abstract global capitalism that we're dealing with, and its representatives, you know, have no sense of allegiance to country, to community, anything like that. There's a very good book written by somebody I once knew who's been deceased for years, Christopher Lash, called Revolt of the Elites, you know, in which he sees the revolution coming from elites, from capital, basically capitalist and media elites. They're the revolutionary class. And I think he was right, Lash. I mean, at the time he wrote this, I wasn't sure, you know, that his analysis would hold up, but it has. The other thing is, well, the left has always had snobs. You know, the whole notion of the vanguard of the proletariat in Marxism is an appeal to snobs. That some people understand the laws of history, the average worker is a dummy who has to be led by the nose, you know. So that goes all that's inherent in communism.
Yes, indeed. But I wonder to what extent is that true, though. I mean, because obviously you are up for hierarchy, you accept hierarchy. So do you judge these left, like champagne socialists, etc., for saying that about the workers, about the peasant class and the proletariat?
Well, I think the situation is so changed by now that we have to recognize that the working class are the embodiments of traditional social and moral values. They've become counter-revolutionaries, something which is not an entirely recent phenomenon. You know, in the French Revolution, as soon as the peasants were given land, they became a counter-revolutionary class. And I think if you lived in the 1960s, as I did, you'd see that the blue-collar working class were the most conservative people in the United States. So this is not a new phenomenon. And to see the capitalists, with their abstract capitalism and their globalist connections, you know, fighting from the left against a morally traditional, communally rooted working class is nothing new for me.
All right. Well, let's get to what I wanted to be what I intended to be the main topic here, which is your view of how America, what America used to be, what it used to represent and mean, and, you know, bringing us to the present day. Because obviously, I don't know about you, but it seems to me like things have been changing a lot rapidly in the last year, but especially the last 5 years, but especially this year. So if you were to talk about America in the year 1900, what would you say it was uniquely? What would you say that America represented at that point? Why did it exist away from Europe? What distinguished it? What was it in the world, 1900?
You know, a lot of it, I think, is sort of an American self-consciousness which distinguishes it from Europe. Because, you know, as an historian writing books on this era and going back and looking at it, Americans don't look all that different from Europeans, particularly Western Europeans. You know, the Germans who came here were like their German cousins. The English were like their English cousins. The French, the Dutch, the others. The Italians were a bit different because they were Southern Italians and they were, you know, very poor peasants, and the same with Eastern Europeans. But, you know, then they took on a kind of bourgeois, they underwent un bourgeoisement. They became sort of a kind of bourgeois class in the United States over a few generations. The thing that I'm always looking at in the past is sort of like counterfactual history. If this or that had not happened, you know, what would the result be? And I'm saying, if I'm looking at the world in 1900, it probably has things that I would correct, or black people weren't treated very well in the United States or something like that. I mean, there are things that obviously had to be mended or fixed or be made a bit more bearable for everyone or something like that. Women, I think, probably had enough rights. I'm not quite sure I'm happy with the 19th Amendment and giving women the votes. I think it's been had a disastrous effect. But I'm totally against the enfranchisement of women. I think it sort of led to everything else that's been bad. It's been horrible and destructive of the family. There are things that we might want to improve. But generally, I would say that, you know, the United States in Europe, had it not headed toward, you know, resulted in a war, which was a fault of both sides. If that war had not come along, things would have been fine. Many of the bad things would have been ironed out in time. And sort of looking at the United States, let's say in 1950, when I was growing up in the 50s, you'd say the same thing, you know, that we were generally headed in the right course. Things were fine. There were some things in 1900 that I think were much better. Music, the arts, much of the social structure, I think, was better back in 1900, maybe even 1850. I don't know. But there is in 1950 it was, you know, better socially or culture, but, you know, it was a highly decent society that I grew up. There were gender roles, even though women voted. Women generally stayed home and raised kids the way my mother did, and the way my first wife, who's now deceased, did. So, you know, that was fine. And my father worked. He supported us. They wanted their kids to go to college. And we went to college, by the way. Our minds were not poisoned by psychotic intellectuals, you know, who hated heterosexuals, who hated males, who were effeminate, whatever nuttiness you now find in the academy. I don't really remember seeing much of that even in the early 60s. The worst that I could say about my professors is I was a Republican and they were Democrats. They liked the New Deal and I didn't, or something like that. They seemed on the whole to be, you know, again, to be decent people.
But yeah, I mean, the American Democrat of the 1960s and 70s was probably, and the 80s even, was probably quite a nice person compared to the American Democrat of today, I would imagine.
Well, no, I think we might also note that when I was growing up in the 1950s, Democrats were culturally the more conservative party. I was a Republican, but Republicans were generally sort of upper class white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. The patrician class were Republicans, so I was a Republican, you know, and I thought these were people I should want to imitate. The Democrats were generally ethnic Catholics who had very conservative family values, and in the South they were the white Southern Protestants. They were very conservative. Republicans tended to be more progressive on women's issues, on civil rights issues. Most of the blacks, by the way, have voted Democratic since the mid-1930s and had nothing to do with the Democrats being more progressive on civil rights, because the Republicans were. But they liked the New Deal. They liked Roosevelt. So the radicalism that we're seeing really doesn't get going until maybe the late 1960s, 1970s.
Yeah, there's the time of the hippies and the free love movement, and then, you know, feminism, queer rights, gay rights, whatever.
Right.
Right. Okay. So, well, I guess this is your story. So would you say that at that point, America was still a stable society in the late 60s?
Well, not by the late 60s, because you already had a violent anti-war movement, and you had a civil rights movement. And my view is that the civil rights movement did focus on some real grievances. Unfortunately, the people who were behind it were quite radical. And destabilized the country. They managed to destabilize it permanently. I think that if Southerners had been a little more magnanimous and allowed, you know, whites to sit at a lunch counter or use a library or something, maybe some of this would have been avoided, because it has been, a continuing explosion in this country since the late 1960s. And I think the civil rights revolution, the legislation that was introduced to deal with racism, discrimination, not only against blacks, by the way, but also against women, and then other groups were added to it and so forth. This has made the government, the deep state, whatever you want to call public administration, and public education into vehicles of radicalization. And this has been going on since the mid to late 1960s.
Right. And so how did that develop into, like, what's the difference between America in the, let's say, the late 60s and America in the mid 80s? What changes would you say took place in that period?
Well, I think by the 1980s, what has happened is you've consolidated the gains of the 1960s and 1970s. It's not that, you know, Ronald Reagan came along and carried out a counter-revolution. If he did, I missed it entirely. I didn't see anything, you know, doing anything very dramatic in government. This is one of the myths of conservatism incorporated, that he was some kind of counter-revolutionary. He was not. He hardly made any difference. And I worked in the Reagan administration, and he pretty much left everything in place in the government bureaucracy. However, there is no new initiatives that are going to come until later. You don't have gay legislation or anything like that. Gay marriage is very recent. It has now become a pillar of human rights and American national identity, gay marriage.
Oh, yeah, and it came out of nowhere.
Yeah,
about 10 years ago.
It hardly existed until recently. I mean, now the conservative movement affirms it as a human right of some kind. We're angry at Putin because he doesn't have gay marches in Moscow. I was in my 50s. I was a professor. I don't remember any of this stuff in the United States. So I think this is a very recent phenomenon.
So, I mean, where would you say that these things come from then? I mean, what is the how did we get from, again, I'm interested in your interpretation of how this has happened. You know, if we go from America in 1900 to America today, I mean, what are the threads that carry us?
Yeah, I think there are certain alliances that get built among groups, like-minded groups. The government or the deep state or bureaucracy, call it what you want, becomes committed to this. The Department of Education, which is created just as a political payoff under Jimmy Carter, becomes a major vehicle for social educational revolution once you put it in place, because of the kind of people that it attracts, and the kind of people who are chosen to head these agencies. The conservative movement is almost entirely concerned with one thing, making war. You know, wars to spread democracy, the defense industry, this kind of junk. I mean, this is what they care about. Heritage Foundation, this is what we have a book called The Vanishing Tradition, which is an anthology of essays on the conservative movement that came out with Cornell last year. And we have several essays just showing what conservatives incorporated wants to do. They don't care if you have gay marriage, if you tear down Confederate statues, as long as you don't tear down Lincoln's statue, you know, yet.
Not yet.
Maybe next month, but, you know, after they make another bargain or negotiate or something. but there's really nothing standing in the way of these alliances. Another important force are the media throughout the Western world. I mean, the media have become kingmakers. Joe Biden should get on his knees and, you know, kiss the feet of Jeff Zucker and the owner of the New York Times. They put him in the White House. You know, they suppress stories that could have led to his defeat in the election and so forth. They weaken Trump with constant attacks. The media want all these things. They want transgendered restrooms and so forth. So it's the rise of the media here and in every other Western democracy. It's exactly the same. In fact, our media is probably to the right of the media in Canada, Germany, Sweden, and other countries. So you have similar things. You have the growth of a radicalized government administration and the media, and of course the educational establishment. Which is part of the state. It's part of the state bureaucracy. It's the part of the state bureaucracy that conditions and socializes the young, because their parents are off working, so the schools will socialize them, and the media will socialize the young. So I think it's the coming together of these forces which allow the culturally radical left to do so well in the last 20 to 30 years.
And so I guess that would bring us to the last sort of year let's talk about the 2010s first. I mean, can you think of any social trends that took place in that time, any changes? I mean, it started with gay marriage, as we said earlier. Mm-hmm. That was a very strange thing. It just out of the blue, suddenly gay marriage was an essential. It had to be legalized everywhere, and that happened. But also the decade started with Occupy Wall Street. I think that was 2010, 2011. And or maybe just before that with the global financial crisis. And I think that it's interesting to me, because I don't think that Occupy Wall Street would happen now, because Antifa now seem to be completely at home with the banks, with big business, mass capitalism, whereas as recently as 10 years ago, they were, or the left, were in opposition to those things, at least ostensibly.
I'm glad you used the word ostensibly, because I never took it seriously. You know, it's like looking at Italian fascism and saying, well, they're really enemies of Italian capitalism. No, they were not. They, you know, you just have to forget about some of their rhetoric. The people who led this, like Mark Bray, who wrote this book on Antifa, who led the Occupy Wall Street movement, is primarily concerned with fighting sexism, racism, homophobia, those sorts of things. That's what his anti-fascism is. He occasionally invokes Marxist or communist of the interwar years, but that's just for show. That's rhetorical show. Wall Street is an alliance with the cultural social left, despite the show of the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations 10 years ago. So, and even before that, I think there was an alliance. So one of the things I've been criticizing lately is the way so-called conservatives say we have to fight the left because we're fighting Marxism or socialism. Or this is the same thing you have in Venezuela. The answer is no, it's not. It has nothing to do with what's going on in Venezuela. It's cultural social radicalism, which is being advanced by capitalists. You know, so this is not a replay of communism. It's nothing to do with it. And you know, but for Republicans, it's very useful to say that it is, because there are people who remember the Cold War when the enemy was communism. And then there are people from Cuba who fled Castro, you know, who voted for Trump because he said he was against socialism. So it is politically useful, but it's totally misleading.
So then what actually is going on? Do you think capitalism has discovered that it can use the rhetoric of the left in order to maximize its own profit?
That's part of it, that, you know, they see... You know, the if we're nice to the feminists, and if women, you know, go out and work, they'll earn more money. They won't stay home, say, having kids, and you know, they'll spend all the money. They'll spend money on the things that or the junk that we're peddling, or they'll buy more stocks or something. You want to keep everybody making money, everybody working. You also, I suppose, don't want national borders, because you want to import cheap labor from Asia or something like that. I mean, you can find economic reasons why capitalists are doing this, but I think it goes beyond the economic reasons. I think that the people who deal with this abstract capitalism, the banking, the stocks, who are essentially globalists, hate ordinary white male Christians or, you know, ordinary people. They loathe them. And they're, you know, they're quite happy to ally themselves with blacks, inner city blacks, and with Antifa that want to tear down this and shoot cops. They don't care. They have their own police force anyhow. They're protected in their high rise apartments. What do they care? I think if I'm looking for villains, I think these woke capitalists are the most dangerous people in Western society today.
They definitely enable a lot of destruction. They definitely and finance a lot of destruction and promote it. I wonder what you would say about the theory that there is an ethnic religious component to this, because some people are asking about this, and you've no doubt you're familiar with the JQ. What would you say about that?
I don't know what the JQ is. If you want me to say that Jews and Asians are disproportionately represented here, absolutely. I mean, people from India, I always make the distinction between Eastern European and German Jews. German Jews always try to assimilate. They try to become, you know, junior partners of WASP. Eastern European Jews have a real dislike for Christians who persecuted them in Eastern Europe or their ancestors. People from the Third World have no loyalty to white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, but they see as white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture. So I think that it is very important to remember that groups that view themselves as marginalized, even if they're not in fact marginalized, people who have this self-perception are going to be particularly open to this sort of woke capitalism. This is not surprising. I think one of the great catastrophes in American history is the collapse of this WASP patriciate that, you know, ran American society for a very long time. They might have been, you know, snobbish and intolerant to this, but I mean, considering what took their place, I have nostalgia for them.
Well, yes, indeed. It seems like something from, it is something from another era. It seems it's just gone now, really, the WASP elite. And it's something that's very easy to feel nostalgic about. So you would say that I mean, to what extent is the, because this is an interesting question. There obviously there are minorities involved in what is now called wokeism, wokeology, woke capitalism. There are all sorts of minorities involved in that because they feel marginalized and they're encouraged to feel marginalized, so they get into it. But to what extent would you say that it's also an expression of the well, WASPism? There are a WASP element, this sort of Northern European morality or moralizing. To what extent would you say that that is a component of the woke thing or progressivism?
Well, I mean, if you read my book on multiculturalism and the politics of guilt, that's precisely the argument. I think there are elements of Northern European Protestantism that are absorbed into multiculturalism. But the argument I'd make is most of these WASP leftists think very differently from minorities which are reacting because they feel marginalized. My own experience, having lived among all these groups, is that certainly the liberal Protestants I know are afflicted with a deep guilt feeling, you know, that our group did this, and that we marginalized, we killed Indians, we Native Americans, we had slaves, and this. Whereas Jews, Indians, Chinese couldn't give a damn. You know, it's you people over there, you did it. You know, and we're just trying to right your wrong right now. So it's a very different attitude. There's liberal Protestants always strike me as people who are full of self-hate.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, these other groups, I don't have self-hate. They just don't like the WASP majority.
So it's a very dangerous thing for the WASP majority or the white American majority to engage in self-hate, because there are so many minorities who will help them in that.
Right.
Who will say, yeah, you should hate yourself and you should deconstruct yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess you could say that, you know, each group should look after its own interests, because no other group will do that on its behalf.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right. Since the waning of WASP rule in America, things have become a lot worse. Because these minorities generally are held together by what they hate, as well as the desire to make money and do well individually and send their kids to some Ivy League school. You know, it's not that they necessarily hate. That's the wrong word. They actually hate the dominant group. In the United States, it's that they always feel uneasy when they're in power. At some point, they're going to take it away from us. At some point, they're going to kick us out. They're going to, you know, divest us of our wealth. So we better be careful that other groups come in here and mix things up a bit more. And we can't have any of this Old Testament morality, which the Protestants took over from the Jews. We can't have any of this stuff because, you know, this... This is cultural and morally specific, and it might lead to other things that are even worse, you know, even more so, more of these traditional social controls. And we don't want that, because that's part of a society that we're trying to get rid of.
So what do you see the future bringing then for, I mean, we'll talk about America specifically. Do you see these trends continuing? And if so, what's in store for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in America?
Well, you know, I don't think it looks very good for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in America. But, you know, it's interesting that other societies, which are, let's say, French Catholics in France, I'm not going to bet on them. I'm not going to bet on any of the German Christians. But the Germans I have no sympathy for, because they're so eager to destroy themselves. You know, their collective masochism is so contemptible that I don't feel sorry for them anymore. But in the case of America, I think it's pretty much gone for WASPism. They've allowed themselves to be destroyed too. You know, they're quite willing to be walked on. They want to be liked. You know, I sort of like look at Republican politicians who are predominantly WASP, and I find them contemptible people. I almost like Chuck Schumer more than McConnell. I cannot stand Leffler and Perdue running in Georgia. Every time you call them racist, they're terrified. They don't want to be called racist. They're being called racist by black Nazis, you know, like Warnock and the others, but they're afraid. Don't call me this. And, you know, I have a racist bone in my body. And of course, these are people who are friendly with Louis Farrakhan and this, who have Black Lives Matter signs in front of their houses. Why are they so cowardly? I mean, their ancestors, you know, fought for the Confederacy, fought against Union armies invading them. And so I don't know if it's true in their case. Loeffler is probably German. They probably came later. You sort of wonder what's happened to some of these people. I mean,
do you have any answer to that? Why are they? Why are they so cowardly?
Well, I mean, they've been made to, because of public education and because of their religions, which stress guilt, you know, these sort of liberal Protestant religions, these people have been made to feel ashamed of their own roots. And or they are terrified that someone questions their virtue by saying they're racist. Sort of listening to this, you know, my reaction is if somebody told me that, you know, who has just met with Louis Farrakhan or Black Lives Matter, I would say go to hell. I mean, why do you put up with this crap from these people? It's something in their nature by now. I don't quite understand this. I think it's the way they're educated. It's the things they've been told about themselves. Why don't they protest if their Confederate grave sites are being vandalized? If their statues are being pulled down, why don't they care? Unlike the Italians in New York who defended the Statue of Columbus, by the way, for a long time, and said they would beat up anybody who tried to take it. But then Italians behave differently from the sort of decadent Southern WASP.
Well, I think that they have been so deconstructed that they can't even entertain the idea that they would defend, first of all, that they've got anything to defend, and second, that it would be right to defend it. I mean, their identity has been so demonized. I mean, you know, I've seen this all my life in American popular culture, the deconstruction of white middle-class Christian America. That's just been relentless in films and so on.
The question is, why would they let this? This is the question I ask about multiculturalism. Why would they let this happen to them? I cannot imagine Japanese allowing this to happen to themselves. I can't imagine Russians allowing this to happen to themselves. I can imagine Germans. I can imagine Americans. I can imagine Canadians, but not these other groups. So I think there is something inherent in these cultures that make these people willing to despise themselves and despise their ancestors.
I think that there is clearly some kind of vulnerability that's being exploited, some kind of psychological vulnerability in them that there must be in the first place for this to have begun, some kind of desire for the greater good, I think, a concern for the well-being of the other, which was then weaponized against them. Themselves, and then to the point where they now think that they've got to give up literally everything, even their own existence, to the other.
You know, I think there is that element of altruism, but I think combined with that is a sense of shame. I'm supposed to be ashamed of what I am. Like when, you know, Kelly Loeffler in Georgia swimming, I don't have a racist bone in my body, responding to a black racist by saying that. You know, you are a black racist. No, I don't have a racist bone in my body. And by the way, Loeffler and Perdue voted to rename Southern Army bases that were named for Confederate soldiers, Confederate generals. They're now going to give them different names. The two senators from Georgia voted for that. I cannot imagine a black person voting to rename something with a black name. Could you? I mean, you know, it's inconceivable.
No, of course not. But other, I mean, minority groups who are not going to remain minorities for forever, they just don't seem to have the same capacity for self-hatred. It's quite remarkable. You know, as a Northern European myself, it's quite remarkable that there is such a sort of shameless, because, you know, shameless pride in their own identity, whereas we are so walking on treading on eggshells, Northern Europeans, about this kind of thing, especially nowadays. I don't know if we were always like this. I doubt it. I don't think we could have been if we had empires and so on. But it's definitely something that has developed over the last 100 years. And that's why I asked you about America before the First World War, to compare it with today. Because I would say that the First World War was a huge turning point. And obviously the Second World War as well.
No, I think the Second World War was more important because the struggle against Nazism was used, we might say, to weaponize the left against so-called white racists. And in the beginning, there may have been people who were segregationists. It just went on and on, though. So, as I argue in my book on anti-fascism, the word fascist and Nazi, are so manipulated. They mean anything that the left doesn't want, is that you become a fascist or, you don't want the transgendered restroom. You're a Nazi.
Well, at this point, the men who fought and defeated the Nazis are themselves called Nazis or equivalent to Nazis.
Exactly. Yeah. It does make, because as soon as you defy the latest demand of the left, whatever it happens to be, women, men competing in women's athletic contests, that's not a good idea. Well, this is like Hitler. And this will somehow lead to Auschwitz or something. I mean, you listen to these, and people actually say this. It's almost impossible to argue against this because Nazism, Hitler, fascism, these are the ultimate evils, and they never go away. They just get worse over time. The longer they fade into the past, the worse they're becoming. And this is what I argue in my book. So this is sort of the ultimate evil. So I think World War II is important for that because the struggle against Nazism is going to be converted into long after the Nazis are defeated, it's going to be converted into a continuing struggle or crusade against fascism, meaning anyone who disagrees with the left, ultimately becomes a fascist. So, but even in the 1950s, people were normal. you don't have to go all the way back to 1900. Even in the 1950s, they were normal. It's in the 1960s, when I was in college and graduate school, I could see the change coming, particularly graduate school. I was in graduate school in Yale, and you could see among the more progressive types, they were sort of leaning in this direction. What sort of holds it back on the left, and I've argued this, is the Cold War. Because for many decades, all the left cared about, just about the only thing they cared about, was defending the communists. The communists were the good guys. Ho Chi Minh was a nice fellow. You misunderstand Stalin and so forth. So they spent all their effort went into defending the communists. They were occasionally concerned about civil rights, but this was almost a kind of, secondary activity. They were busy opposing the United States in the Cold War. And defending the communists. Once the communist empire dissolves, the left really becomes bad. I mean, what happens is that these left-wing, culturally leftist socialists take over from the communists. The communists were relatively normal. It's the people coming afterwards who are really extreme on these cultural, social questions.
Well, I've heard one theory about that, which is that the Soviet Union collapsed partly because of lack of the support for it from the West. Mm-hmm. Ended,
right?
Because it was no longer needed. They'd now become so ingrained, so embedded in Western social systems and institutions that they no longer needed the Soviet Union as a sort of test bed, experimental zone for communism. Because they could now enact it in the West itself.
Yeah, I think the Soviets were a threat because they were sort of, they made mischief internationally. The argument that they were essentially Russian nationalists is probably true, just the way the Chinese communists are Chinese nationalists. I really couldn't find much that looked like communism in the Soviet Union, but certainly by the end of Soviet rule. Although they appeal to Marx and Lenin and so forth, I mean, it's like looking. I said it was sort of like looking for Christianity in the counter Reformation papacy of the 16th century. It's sort of hard to find Jesus and his disciples there, right? I mean, the thing is so transformed. And that was my impression of, in case of China, you know, you simply have an authoritarian nationalist government that gives itself the label communism, which, by the way, allows Republicans, you know, to make a lot of noise that we're fighting the communists and so forth. I mean, they're fighting Chinese nationalist competitors at this point, right now.
I mean, I would say that by the end of the Soviet Union, it was largely just trying to pragmatically survive from one year to the next. So the ideology had been largely given up on, as far as I understand it.
Right. It was a question of control, maintaining control.
Yeah. Okay, so a question to end with then. You said that the future doesn't look good in America for white people, for European Americans. What would you say that, I mean, what would you advise people to do, if anything? If you can think of something, something constructive, what would you advise the listeners, the viewers, to do?
Well, one of the things that's happening now is I think there is a resistance which is mounting in the United States. And, you know, you have 75 million people voted for Trump. I don't think Trump is the answer to everything. I don't think he was particularly conservative. But the people who associate themselves with Trumpism are, in many cases, profoundly right-wing. And they do represent the heartland of the country, the white working class. There's some minorities there, but then they ally themselves with the white working class. I think that there is the possibility in this country of holding back the left. But we're simply going to have to develop bolder, more forceful means of doing this. The Republican Party is pretty much useless as a force of opposition. We're going to need another a party on the populist right. We're going to need populist leaders. The idea of sort of going back to, I started out as a Robert Taft Republican. I don't think this matters much anymore. I think what we need is a right-wing populist reaction, and it's going to come. In European countries like England or France or Germany, I don't expect that to happen. But I think in the United States, because of our traditions of gun-bearing citizens, the defense of traditional Christian communities and so forth in this country, there is an opposition, a serious opposition to the left. Now, they do not control the educational system. They do not control the media. They do certainly do not control the deep state. But they're a presence. And, you know, they came out, they voted for Trump, and they're not going to go away, and they're going to demonstrate. And you noticed in Washington when the Antifa and the Black Lives Matter attacked these demonstrators, the Proud Boys came to their aid and pushed back Antifa. And we can expect more of this to happen. So what I'm saying is that the left really has not won definitively in the United States. There's a force of resistance. Finally, another hope that I have in this country, but also in other Western countries, is that the left is going to fall apart. The left is an implausible alliance of groups held together by hate. They all hate white Anglo-Saxon Protestants or white Christian male heterosexuals or whatever. They're joined by their hate, whether it's black nationalists, whether it's feminists, whether it's LGBT. They know what they hate. They know what they want to destroy. They have really no positive vision. And I think at a certain point, they're simply going to start falling out with each other. I don't think that this is a stable alliance on the left. Now, they could make a lot of trouble. In the case of Europe and Germany, they just invite in, you know, hordes of Muslims to come in who are going to create panic and havoc in the country. And the people do not even react politically. They're beyond that point in Germany. But I do think that the groups on the left are going to start to fight in the end. I don't think the woke capitalists will be very happy when Black Lives Matter come and try to blow up their houses and burn down their apartments. They're not going to be happy with that. And I think that it's inevitable that there will be this kind of conflict breaking out on the left. And in the United States, I think we do have the advantage of a large and in some ways well-organized right-wing opposition.
Right. So you would, that's interesting because you sound like you're cautiously optimistic.
Yes, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Right, okay. And I guess to briefly ask you, are you cautiously optimistic about this, about the situation in Europe as well, or not?
Less so. I'm very optimistic about Eastern Europe. I'm optimistic about Hungary, Poland, Russia, the Baltic states, probably Slovakia, the Czech Republic. those places will hang on. I don't think there's any future for Germany, because whatever we see here exists in an even more exaggerated form there. I don't know about England. I don't feel quite confident about England, certainly not about Scotland or Ireland. France, I think the populists are in a losing position. Having studied this and knowing a great deal about French populism, they just don't have the numbers. You know, their numbers peak at about 31% in election. That's about what their candidate of the Rassemblement National will win in the presidential, the presidential race. they have nothing like the numbers that we have here on the right. Italy perhaps has a better chance of survival. They're more Latin rather than Germanic, which gives them an advantage.
Yeah. The Italians are also just less bothered about what other people say about them, I think,
right.
other countries. So they've got some of the shamelessness that that I think we all need in pursuit of our group's interests. Because after all, as I said before, you know, if your own group doesn't fight for its interests, no other group will do it for it. So I think that's something that we all really need to internalize, because you know, if you give yourself to the rest of the world, they'll just eat you. I mean, that seems to be the way of it. Okay, well, on that rather grim note, okay, I'll end it. So this was Paul Gottfried, and thank you very much for taking part in Millennial 2020. Hope you've enjoyed this interview, as it's probably been a bit more broad than you're used to.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much. Bye. And I'll see the rest of you soon. Bye for now.